From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Last week's bombing of Iraq was a vivid reminder that tensions are ongoing in the Persian Gulf. It's been nearly 10 years since the ground war there began. On today's show, we feature an interview with Alex Vernon and Greg Downey, two tank lieutenants who led platoons for the first time in the Gulf War. They've contributed to a new book, The Eyes of Orion. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the complete VJ, Lee Morgan, Wayne Shorter sessions on the Mosaic label. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI says a longtime agent has been arrested and charged with spying for Russia and the former Soviet Union. Federal prosecutors accused Robert Hansen of betraying American secrets in exchange for $1.4 million in cash and diamonds. Attorney General John Ashcroft said the case would be vigorously prosecuted.
The arrest of Robert Hansen for espionage should remind us all. Every American should know that our nation, our free society, is an international target in a dangerous world.
Prosecutors say Hansen went to work for the Soviets in 1985. Over the years, they accuse Hansen of giving Moscow the identities of at least three Russians who were alleged double agents for the United States. Two of those men were later tried and executed in Russia. Secretary of State Colin Powell met his German counterpart today for talks that touched on U.S. plans to build a missile defense and Europe's plans for a rapid reaction force. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Powell told German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer that Washington would like to see a European force that complements NATO and does not weaken the transatlantic alliance.
We have to add to overall capability, and we have to make sure we don't start creating new parallel and perhaps conflicting planning and executional structures.
It's an argument Powell made as well when he met recently with British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook. European countries plan to set up a mobile force to deal with humanitarian crises. Fischer argued this would strengthen NATO. He also said he'd welcome further consultations on the U.S. plans to develop a national missile defense, opposed by Russia and China. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
California is one step closer to setting up a public power agency that would build, buy, and operate power plants in the state. The idea behind the plan is to reduce the state's reliance on out-of-state suppliers that have been charging high prices for electricity. Ellen Cherchak reports from Sacramento for member station KQED.
The measure passed the state Senate on party lines, with Democrats for, Republicans against. Democratic Senate Leader John Burton authored the bill.
I think you ask the people of this state, would they rather have the state of California involved in this, or all of these generating companies from Texas and Oklahoma that have been gouging us for these many months, and I think they would opt for their own state government.
Private utilities in California say they are facing bankruptcy because of the high prices wholesalers have been charging since the electricity market was deregulated. But Republican opponents of the Public Power Authority say California could reduce reliance on outside supplies by luring private investors to the state to build more power plants. For NPR News, I'm Ellen Cherchak in Sacramento.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 69 points. This is NPR News from Washington. President Bush traveled to the Midwest today to promote his education and tax cut proposals. At an elementary school in Columbus, Ohio, he said his new budget will call for adding $5 billion for elementary school reading programs over the next 5 years. The president repeated his call for yearly testing to hold schools accountable for how much children learn. Later, in St. Louis, he introduced a family of middle-class Americans he said would see substantial benefits from his proposed $1.6 trillion tax cut. Authorities in Newcastle, Indiana, are holding two teenagers suspected in the stabbing deaths of two Dartmouth professors last month. 17-year-old Robert Tulloch and 16-year-old James Parker faced two counts each of first-degree murder. Will Murphy reports from member station WFIY.
Tulloch and Parker appeared in Henry County Court to face extradition to New Hampshire. Through his attorney, Tulloch waived extradition, and Henry County Sheriff's officials say he will be returned within the next few days. Parker appeared in court late Tuesday afternoon, and his attorney asked that the extradition hearing be postponed for a week while they determine whether he will fight a return to New Hampshire. That request was granted. And meanwhile, Parker and Tulloch remain in custody without bond. Law enforcement agencies had been looking for the two since the bodies of Hoff and Suzanne Zantop were discovered at their home January 27th. Tulloch and Parker were apprehended at a truck stop in Newcastle, Indiana, early Monday morning after a Henry County deputy learned on his CB radio that two male hitchhikers were looking for a ride to California. For NPR News, I'm Will Murphy in Bloomington, Indiana.
In stocks today, the Nasdaq lost 107 points. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. 10 years ago, the war in the Persian Gulf was underway. Air attacks had been going on for more than a month, and the ground war against Iraq was about to begin. In the ground war, which lasted 4 days, the coalition's forces destroyed 363 of Iraq's armored vehicles and captured over 5,000 prisoners. There's been much controversy since over whether the attack was stopped too soon, and the recent bombing raid on Iraqi air defenses suggests that the situation is still a long way from being settled. A new book about the Gulf War, The Eyes of Orion, was written by five lieutenants who were among the first to drive their tanks into Iraq. Alex Vernon and Greg Downey are our guests today. They spoke with NPR's Neil Conan for Fresh Air. Conan reported on the war for NPR and was held hostage by the Iraqi Republican Guard for 4 days. The two biggest concerns the tank commanders had going into the ground war were chemical weapons and the possibility of American forces firing on their own. Greg Downey's platoon did face this friendly fire. Conan asked him how they knew it was Americans and not the Iraqis.
Well, it's kind of ironic that it's kind of like two competing basketball teams. One has a red jersey, one has a green jersey. And that's basically the way we looked at the fire. The tracers on the Iraqi weapons of the larger caliber ammunition was a green tracer, whereas mostly the coalition forces used a red tracer, and that's the phosphorus on the rounds. So, you know, you try to keep it as simple as possible. Obviously, you want to keep your situational awareness to the point where you know who's to the front and who's to the rear of your unit. Now, when you're a scout platoon, that's a pretty easy thing to do because basically everything to your front is enemy. And hopefully nothing to your rear is enemy, but sometimes that may be the case. But in the friendly fire incidents that we did have or did encounter, I could tell immediately, especially at night when the good majority of our friendly fire incidents happened, I could identify the round being fired as friendly just due to the fact that I could see the tracer on it, and it would be glowing bright red as it flew by. So that right there, you just try to keep it as simple as possible and get it turned off as quickly as you can.
Alex Vernon, you were in a tank platoon commanding an M1A1 Abrams platoon. You had some more existential concerns before even Operation Desert Shield started. But when the moment came to cross the line and go into Iraq, I mean, was there time to worry about those sorts of things?
It's a pretty fascinating phenomenon when you cross the border, because you're right, you don't have time to worry about anything but the task at hand. And it's thinking back on the behavior of my platoon, I mean, up until the moment we crossed, when we would talk about what we might expect, when we would go through battle drills and do our training, my soldiers would always ask questions, and good questions, and why are we doing it this way, and why are we doing it that way? But as soon as we crossed the border, everything that I said, they responded to instantly, you know, without hesitation. They implicitly trusted that that's what had to be done. They trusted me. And they were as focused as I was on the task at hand.
That first night after you crossed the border into Iraq, you describe your tanks driving across the desert as if they were flying.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
It's really interesting. Greg had the advantage and disadvantage as a scout platoon leader of being up front, so he had to navigate, which I do not envy him for in the middle of the night. But the difference that I had was I had to maintain within a formation of several hundred vehicles. I had to maintain my position, my platoon's position, my company's position. So, I mean, it did feel like we were flying because we were following in our place in the formation. And you know, my driver, he was focused on another vehicle in formation. And when he couldn't see that, I was trying to direct him as best I could. So it did feel like we were being pulled along and we were flying and we were going as fast as those as the conditions could permit, given the sand and the rain of that first night. So it certainly did feel, in a sense, like we were flying, yeah.
Greg Downey, before you served in the Bradley in the scout platoon, you too were a tank lieutenant, and you have some remarkable things to say about the M1A1 Abrams.
It's a work of art. I was always fascinated with the complexity of that combat vehicle and the ability of those engineers, whoever pieced that together, to be able to combine, just as I liken it to a combination of a heavyweight and a lightweight boxer, just because of the agility of that 70-ton piece of steel, which, you know, you think about 70 tons of steel, you don't really associate agility with that. But in the case of this, it had the brute force to just to take down a target, but at the same time to be able to dance around with it until the target exposed its chin, so to speak. I have a great amount of respect for that vehicle, and I think that's something that hopefully they will keep that vehicle around for a while and just continue to improve upon it.
In the beginning of the book, Eyes of Orion, you have a comment from Mark Helprin from a lecture at the U.S. Military Academy back in 1992. "I don't know how many of you have been in the presence of a main battle tank," he writes, "or if you have, what you felt. I have an infantryman's view of tanks, which is to say, I've never been exactly comfortable with them. If you're on one side of a village and a tank arrives on the other side, you feel it before you hear it. You feel it in your solar plexus and in the soles of your feet. You would never think that something so massive could be so agile as it smashes through walls and pulverizes bricks, the things you thought you could hide behind. And then it slews its gun. The sound of the turret turning is like the sound of death itself. That's one tank. In the Gulf War, columns of armor rolled across the desert for days and days, so vast and long that the dust they raised could have been seen from the moon." Alex Vernon, you were in one of those columns of tanks, and you too described the tank as a thing of beauty.
The M1 tank is an amazing piece of design. It is the perfect marriage of form and function. It does exactly what it was designed to do, better than any other vehicle that I know of, with that particular function. It's the things that the fire system are able to handle. It has, for example, a wind sensor that's constantly taking in wind data and feeding it into the computer to adjust the round you put in when you first get your rounds. You put into the computer even the lot number, production lot number for the round, so it can adjust for anything peculiar in the production of those particular rounds. It accounts for so much, and it's an amazing piece of equipment.
I remember before the ground war started, one of the concerns was that the M1A1 Abrams, which is a very complicated piece of machinery, that all of this fancy stuff wouldn't work under the harsh conditions in the desert. As it happened, however, Alex, you have, I think it was you describing one scene where you're feeling rounds ricocheting off your turret, and describe how comfortable you feel.
Absolutely. I mean, and those were the rounds that I remember feeling were small arms, or they might have been shrapnel from mortar fire. And I was not particularly concerned because you could hear them sort of bouncing off, dinging off the side of the tank. I would want to be in no other place on a battlefield besides being inside a tank. I mean, obviously, the disadvantage is you're the vehicle that everybody's gunning for. But the armor protection on the M1 tank is pretty amazing. Unlike many other countries, the M1 tank was designed with crew safety in mind, largely. One example, the rounds are stationed in a separate compartment behind the crew with doors that separate the crew from the rounds. So if any kind of shrapnel or anything gets into the rounds, they explode outward and not into the crew compartment.
Greg Downey, as you approached the airfield that was your main objective, and as it turned out, the main battle that your unit fought, there were a couple of extraordinary moments, the first of which you found yourself taking fire from Iraqi forces.
Yes, that actually happened prior to the battle, the night before the Battle of Jalabah, and that was really the first significant contact that my my scout platoon had come under. It was mostly in the form of artillery, which, as I described in the book, is quite harrowing, simply because you can't see exactly who is shooting at you, and it's kind of a roll of the dice on where you move next. It was a great baptism in fire for what was to come the next morning, and I think in a way it was kind of an icebreaker for the platoon to go through, simply because of the volume that we received at the time.
You write about it this way. You say, incoming artillery plays with you. You never know where the next round will fall. I had terrible feelings of paranoia, like somebody was looking at me through a pair of binoculars, carefully plotting my location and calling for the next barrage, which was exactly what was happening.
Yes, that's exactly what was happening. And to my surprise, not that I underestimated the enemy, but to my surprise, in the vast open desert, with the lack of technology that I thought the Iraqi army had, whoever was calling that artillery was very good. I would like to have met that person just to see, obviously, a very competent soldier at what they did, because they were able to drop that artillery in such close proximity to myself and to my other scouts.
And what did you do?
That's where training takes over. The way I always looked at it is try to keep things as simple and basic as possible in contact, and you simply just reposition yourself, and you continue to reposition yourself until hopefully at some point in time you can either get a location on the artillery itself, which is doing the firing, which is exactly what took place. We have this nice little thing called a counter-battery radar in the military, which basically hones in on the artillery unit that is firing, and then drops our own artillery on that to squelch their actions, which thankfully for me is exactly what was taking place. The battlefield's a very dynamic thing, and the nice thing about it is, particularly in the U.S. Army, is you have redundant systems. And even though I was not concentrating on shutting down their artillery, thank heavens for myself and my scout platoon, somebody in the division was concentrating on that and was able to redirect some of our artillery onto their artillery pieces to shut them down.
And there was a moment then not long afterwards in which you found the positions reversed. You were in the position of the observer calling in the artillery.
Yes, and that's really the primary weapon of a scout, is the use of artillery. The old adage is that you do not want to get into a direct firefight with the enemy if you are a scout. Preferably you use your radio, your binoculars, and that artillery unit that's 15, 20 kilometers behind you to do the destruction that you need to do. Obviously, I liked the advantage better when I was doing the calling. You feel a little more in control of your destiny, and really that's what you're called upon to do as a scout reconnaissance platoon.
The fire you called in was devastating.
Very much so. At the time I was 25 years old, I had never, ever witnessed the devastating effect that our artillery units could put down on the enemy. Obviously, in training, you try to replicate, give these soldiers an idea of what to expect. But until you see a battalion of 8-inch artillery land or a battery of MLRS rockets impact, and basically take out a whole square kilometer, you really haven't lived until you've seen that. And the first time you see it, it's an eye-opener. And that's from an observer standpoint. I couldn't imagine being the target of that, just because of the devastation. And you, at that point in time, you really start to respect the firepower that we have in our arsenal. And that's just the tactical level stuff that we have. But it was something to see.
You write about meeting an Iraqi captain who was one of the survivors of a commando brigade that you had called artillery on. And he said that only 49 of 650 men in that brigade had survived the attack. I had called the artillery that erased the lives of over 600 human beings. In 45 minutes, I'd killed more people than what lived in my hometown of Myrna, Nebraska.
Yeah, that's at the time, that's what I thought. The significance of it hit me. And that's something that at the time, you know, you have the fog of war, and you're, just as Alex stated, that you're focused on the task at hand. You don't put a lot of thought to it generally. As time goes on, obviously, you put more thought to it. And looking back on it, it's still one of those things where it teaches you that war is a horrific way to settle differences.
Greg Downey and Alex Vernon, lieutenants who fought in the Persian Gulf War, speaking with NPR's Neil Conan. More of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview NPR's Neil Conan recorded with Alex Vernon and Greg Downey, who led platoons in the Gulf War.
Alex Vernon, you were involved in the attack on the airfield. Your platoon was one of the units that was involved in the attack. And sort of on the opposite end, there's a moment when somebody calls out and there's a missile coming towards you, a wire-guided missile.
I'm not recalling that particular moment. I believe Greg was on the receiving end of a
wire-guided
missile.
That was you, too?
That was actually one of my scouts, Staff Sergeant Deem, who is one of my scout section leaders, was moving up towards the airfield just minutes prior to Alex and the rest of the tanks and Bradley's and the main body of the battalion and the brigade rolling up there. And once again, you fall back on training. Staff Sergeant Deem noticed a puff of smoke, which we had trained for. Lucky for us, the missile moved much slower than what I had been led to believe it would move. We were able to establish eye contact with the missile itself, which helped us time our maneuver away from it. Proper training, you know, there's one thing that I learned from the Gulf War is that there is no sacrifice for hard work. That's what keeps you alive in combat, and obviously that's what all of our soldiers train to do, and they train hard to stay alive in combat, and training does take over.
Alex Vernon, in the attack on this airfield, this was the first time that you knew that you were running up against Republican Guard units. The Iraqis that you'd encountered before had been brushed aside easily. Most of them had rushed to surrender. This, you thought, was going to be different?
Completely. We thought this was going to be different. There were certain things we did not know. We did not know, for example, that when we were rolling up on them from the west, their entrenchments and their weapon systems were facing toward the south. So we kind of rolled them up from the side, which was quite nice. We did not really get – there was an extensive artillery preparation of the airfield, as you can imagine, before we rolled in, before the battle happened. And what – we have found out afterwards, what I have found out from talking to other officers who interviewed prisoners and from reading about it, is that the Iraqis thought that was yet another one of the air bombing campaigns, and they just assumed that once the bombing stopped, the airplanes had gone away, so they came out of their bunkers, having no idea that we were just, I don't know, 200 meters away from them coming down this rise.
So you had scouts out, but they didn't. They didn't know you were coming.
They had no idea we were there.
No.
And it's pretty – I didn't really understand it, I don't think, until after the war when we found some Iraqi vehicles and explored those vehicles and crawled around those vehicles. And I could not imagine doing what we did, making the several hundred kilometer track through the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere, with their equipment. I just can't – I don't think they could have done it. And so I don't think they were able to put themselves in our shoes and sort of conceive of that happening, that we would just appear in the middle of Iraq like that without any warning whatsoever.
Your concern all throughout the war and through Desert Shield earlier was that you feared you were going to endanger your men as a leader, that you weren't qualified to lead your platoon and you were going to get people killed. Now you were coming up against the Republican Guard.
Yeah, and it's probably a feeling that a lot of folks have, a lot of young lieutenants and officers who, when you step into the position and you're a 23-year-old young man, and what I used to say at the time was that the position of a lieutenant needs the body of a 23-year-old, but needs the maturity of like a 35 or 40-year-old, given what the responsibility that you're asked to bear. And I was terrified of that. I was terrified that I would make a mistake, that I would seize up, that I would do something. Wasn't so worried at the time because, again, I had so many other things to think about. I had several radio frequencies to monitor. I had my platoon formation to control, the company formation behind me to control. So, again, I wasn't that worried. And also, you're pretty tired at that point as well. We had been going for 3 days nonstop. I didn't have a whole lot of energy to devote to worrying about my circumstances. We were there, and the only way we were going to get home was by going through that airfield. And so you focus pretty quickly.
Don't picture LaGuardia, you write. There were two paved runways with several hangars on both the north and south sides. A chain-link wire fence surrounded the complex. And you had your first decision to make, Alex, shortly after you went through that fence. A bunker popped up unexpectedly right in front of you.
Right. There was a bunker, and it was probably, 25 meters or so in front of me, and wasn't quite sure initially what to do. I didn't have much time, didn't have many options. I could have, I guess, had my gunner fire his coaxial machine gun, which is mounted right next to the main gun, shares the same sight system. Could have fired that into the bunker, but not sure what good that would have done. So the instant decision that I made was to drive over the bunker and squash it, essentially, because I didn't want to bypass it, because if there were people inside, then suddenly the most vulnerable part of the tanks are the underbelly, the top of the tank, and then the back. And if we had driven past it, bypassed it, then that would have exposed the rear of our tanks to anybody who was, in fact, inside the bunker. So we just drove over it. And I think probably one of the most underestimated capabilities of the tank, especially for the public who has, very little experience watching tanks in action, is called shock effect, which is just the shock, the surprise, the panic that happens that Mark Helprin sort of described when these tanks, these 70-ton monsters, are barreling down at you.
Just terrifying. Not the long-distance killer that we sometimes envision them as.
Exactly. I mean, often that is a horrible way to do your job, but sometimes driving over a bunker is certainly a way of getting it done.
Alex Vernon and Greg Downey, platoon leaders in the Gulf War 10 years ago. They've contributed to the new book, The Eyes of Orion, about waging war on Iraq. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Saab, designing cars with the philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at SaabUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the music of Lee Morgan and Wayne Shorter. Kevin Whitehead reviews a new mosaic box set of their VJ recordings. Also, we continue our conversation with Alex Vernon and Greg Downey, two tank lieutenants who led platoons in the Gulf War. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with Alex Vernon and Greg Downey. 10 years ago, they were platoon leaders during the ground war in the Persian Gulf. They have contributed to a new book about the war, The Eyes of Orion. They spoke with NPR's Neil Conan about their experience.
Greg, you describe another incident where you're calling in artillery fire, and I think this is the day after the battle at the airfield, and describe yourself as feeling tremendously detached, that you really can't connect that what you're doing is causing all of that to happen.
Yeah, it's very surreal. The incident that you're describing is the ammunition depot that was kind of an ad hoc mission that we were sent on, and I remember looking through my binoculars and seeing the faces of the soldiers that were in that ammunition depot as I was calling for artillery to land on that depot, and seeing the fright in their faces and feeling very detached from it. And I was just within shouting distance of these guys. It's an awfully hard thing to imagine because it is so surreal. And I'm not sure that the human mind is prepared to actually make sense of that. And also due to the fact that this was the third day of the ground war, I think I'd slept a total of about maybe 8 hours in a span of 4 days at that point. Your senses become a little bit dull after that point, and I think that probably contributed to that also.
Is there any moment when you feel like you've passed a test, when you feel, well, you know, I'm a competent platoon commander, I'm a veteran, I can do this. Do you set series of hurdles for yourself? If I can do that, then I'll be okay. Alex?
Wow. I don't think so. I mean, just because, as I mentioned before, you never quite know what's going to happen. And even having gone through Jalaba and gone through that particular battle, as soon as Jalaba was over, we were told that we were expected to run into another Republican Guard division that was retreating sort of along the axis that we were advancing on, and we fully expected to have that encounter. So perhaps we had gone through some sort of test by fire at Jalaba, and yet there was something else still to come. And in that particular case, that Republican Guard unit retreating further north would have been headed into us, pointed at us, not pointed away from us as they were at Jalaba. So I think maybe you do get to feel a little bit more confident. Maybe you do get to feel like your soldiers are responding to your commands. And that, you know, you do have an amazing piece of equipment underneath you. But at the same time, everything going forward is still absolutely unknown.
Greg Downey, accidents, of course, will happen in war. On the 2nd of March, you were involved in an incident that I'm sure you've never forgotten.
No, and I don't think it's intended to be forgotten. I think there's a valuable point to be learned from that. Accidents do happen, and that's about the only way that you can cope with something like that.
Describe it for me.
Oh, it hasn't gotten any easier over the past 10 years to think about it. We were into the Ramayah oil fields, which was a congested built-up area, something that we were very unaccustomed to after living in the desert for the last 7 months. Where you have plenty of elbow room, you have no buildings, and all of a sudden we find ourselves in an urban setting, which that in and of itself is a tanker's worst nightmare, and I'm sure Alex will attest to that. We rolled into the Ramayah oil fields after the ceasefire, and the standing orders that we had in terms of engaging the enemy were that if the enemy displayed any hostile acts, then we could fire back in self-defense. And the word that I gave to my scout platoon is that, okay, we know that there is a ceasefire. However, the Iraqi army, which at that time was dispersed all throughout southern Iraq and Kuwait, may not know that there is a ceasefire. So do not endanger the lives of your soldiers, because we had made it as far as we had made it without any casualties. We began our slow block-to-block reconnaissance through the Ramayah oil fields and encountered abandoned vehicles, at least ones that we hoped were abandoned, because it was getting very hard to determine which ones were abandoned and which ones were not abandoned. And, of course, that's always a concern. Just as we were rolling over a berm, a dike that was built up within the Ramayo oil fields as some type of retainer or defensive position, we came face to face with a Soviet-made BMP, which is their version of a Bradley. So it's basically an infantry-type vehicle. Unfortunately for us, that vehicle was manned. It fired around it at my vehicle, which missed. And myself and my wingman, wingman's vehicle, began firing at that BMP about the time that a red tomato truck come flying through the engagement area. Too quick for us to stop firing and did not give the truck driver enough time to figure out what he was about to encounter. Unfortunately, the red truck did travel through the impact area, and rounds did penetrate to the truck. To our terrible surprise, a family began to get out of that truck. And it was an incident where, once again, training takes over. And I think it was kind of a bittersweet thing, because it was a terrible thing to see that we had shot civilians inadvertently. But at the same time, to see the response of the soldiers in the back of those in the back of our Bradleys that jumped out to administer aid to those civilians, totally disregarding their own safety, because it was a hot battlefield at the time. There were some small explosions still taking place, some of the remnants left over after the short, brief firefight that we had. But they were willing to put themselves in jeopardy to administer aid and hopefully, you know, attempt to save the lives of those civilians that found themselves at the wrong place at the wrong time.
What I saw, you wrote, what I saw sickened me. An old man, two women, and six children jumped out of the burning truck. And later you write of the man who'd taken a round from your 25-millimeter chain gun. I couldn't take my eyes off him. His face was blue from his lungs giving up. I tried to block it out, but the mental imprint it left would stay with me. He'd been caught up in something out of his control, and it cost him his life as he tried to protect the lives of his family. This was the lowest, darkest side of combat. I wish I had not experienced it. This incident continues to haunt me. Is there anything in retrospect, from reading it, it doesn't sound like there was anything you could do?
No, there really wasn't. And I think that's the hard thing. You know, as officers and soldiers, one thing you always try to do is control the variables on the battlefield. And this is a very dynamic battlefield, but you do your best to control every variable that you can in order to get the outcome in your favor. And I think that was the thing that really took me aback was that I sit there and I thought and I thought and I thought, what could we have done to prevent that, to control that variable so that didn't happen? And unfortunately, it was a teaching point. It was a learning lesson for me, was that you can't control all the variables. If I could have, I would have at that point, so I wouldn't have to face up to something like that for the rest of my life.
It was also after the ceasefire. It must have seemed particularly pointless.
Yes, it was. You know, a ceasefire is a wonderful thing as long as it's abided by, and we had our strict orders on how to react to the ceasefire. But it also shows that a ceasefire is no assurance of personal safety for anyone on the battlefield, and I think this was a great example of that.
Greg Downey and Alex Vernon speaking with NPR's Neil Conan about their experience leading platoons during the war in the Persian Gulf. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. back with Neil Conan's interview with Alex Vernon and Greg Downey, who fought in the Persian Gulf War 10 years ago.
Alex Vernon, your division had done remarkable things in the 100 hours of the Gulf War. What was your response? What was your reaction when you learned that it was going to end?
If you're talking about when the ceasefire was initially called, which would have been 28 February, our time, I was very relieved. At the same time, I was very cautious because we were 250, 300 kilometers in Iraq, and we knew Iraqi forces were retreating. As Greg said, we did not know, given how shattered the Iraqi army command and control system was, we did not know which Iraqi units knew there, in fact, was a ceasefire, knew, in fact, we were sitting in their backyard. And so I was relieved a little bit, and I was relieved especially because the morning of the ceasefire, we were on our way to run into to attack in the Republican Guard Division. We just knew it was right there in front of us. But at the same time, I was very cautious, and I saw my soldiers and other soldiers around us starting to let down their guard a little bit, starting to relax, wanting to explore bunkers and bring out souvenirs and trophies and things, and that made me incredibly nervous because I knew it wasn't quite. It felt it was over, but it wasn't quite over, and I did not know we would end up in Iraq for another, I think, like 3 weeks after the 28th, patrolling the ceasefire area as well. So that was, and once we finally left Iraq in the middle of, or late March, it didn't feel safe completely until we crossed over the berm into Saudi Arabia. And that's when I sort of felt, okay, it's done, it's over, there are no more surprises, we're going home.
You write that the 100 hours into Iraq, we stopped exactly when we should have. And Alex, you quote a colleague, Jeannie Novak, a lieutenant who'd seen you off from the States and then later traveled with a support battalion attached to the 24th Mechanized Infantry Division. Thank God we stopped when we did, you quote her as saying, we were too full of success. There'd been too much winning.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And obviously the sort of unending question, especially now that George W. has taken over the White House and has inherited the problem of Iraq from his father. There's have been constant questions about whether we stopped when we should have. We were at a point, psychologically, we were at an interesting place because we had been winning, and nothing, there were a few fratricide incidents, but nothing had really sort of shattered our, I guess, psychological momentum, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, our logistical systems were starting to be stretched a little bit thin. I'm thankful we stopped when we did. The mission was over. Hussein had started to leave Kuwait or agreed to leave Kuwait, was leaving Kuwait, and that was what we were there to do. And anything else would have been much more difficult if we had tried to, you know, remove him from power, go after Baghdad. That's the coalition would have fallen apart. B, suddenly there's some moral ambiguity there because now we're going after the sovereignty of Iraq, which is what he did with Kuwait. Going to Baghdad, our logistical lines would have been stretched thin. We would have had some sort of strange occupation force mission of Baghdad. I mean, there's too many variables, too many question marks. I think we stopped when we should have.
Greg Downey, you didn't necessarily agree at that time.
Well, I think it goes back to something that my father ingrained in me at an early age was to never leave the job unfinished. And hindsight is always 20/20, but as the years have passed by, I guess the way I look at it is number one, has Iraq attacked into any sovereign country since the end of the Gulf War? And the answer to that question is no. So did we accomplish our mission there, which that was part of our mission, was to take away their offensive capability. So I feel confident that we accomplished our mission from that end. The other question that I think needs to be asked is how many American soldiers' lives were we willing to sacrifice to pursue Saddam Hussein and to capture him? 5, 100, 1,000 lives. If you remember Operation Just Cause, part of that
Panama
mission.
That was Panama, Manuel
exactly.
Noriega. Yeah.
Exactly, and that became a subset of that mission, was to capture Noriega. Now, Panama is a pretty small country, and he shacked up in the Papal
ministry down there, and consequently that's how we found him, was through information that came from the papal ministry that's where he was at. Hussein could have hid out for dozens of years, and we could have spent dozens of years looking for him. In fact, we could still be looking for him. And to me, the trade-off just wasn't worth it, because we would have lost more lives in search of one person. And I think it all goes back to, did we shut down his offensive capability? And the answer to that question is yes. So mission accomplished in my eyes.
Go ahead.
If I could add to that, Greg, I mean, the question of absolutely how many more American lives would have been risked going after Hussein and perpetuating further destruction on his armed forces, the flip side of that is how many Iraqi lives would also have been lost unnecessarily. When you've got retreating soldiers and civilians in the towns we would have gone through, we're risking even more destruction and killing of folks who are in no shape to fight, to resist. So I think it goes both ways.
There's an extraordinary picture in the book, The Eyes of Orion, Iraqi soldiers posing on a T-72 tank prior to the ground campaign. This was a photograph found on a captured roll of film that was developed. And I wonder, as you look at those guys, and they don't look an awful lot different from what American soldiers would be doing on top of an Abrams tank. You know, one guy flashing the V for victory sign and a bunch of other people crowded around a machine gun. Do you think about those soldiers today, Alex?
I do. I remember during the ceasefire at one time, we would run across some abandoned defensive positions and complexes, and occasionally, one time, usually the infantry would go clear that ground, but there was one time when my company commander allowed myself and a couple of my soldiers to join the infantry on the ground to sort of investigate, and we would go into their little living areas, these bunkers, and we would see their foot lockers and their clothes that they left. And in one case, somebody discovered a diary from an Iraqi soldier. When you're sort of that up close to sort of being where they were living and trying to imagine what they were living, going through with the air campaign, absolutely, I feel some connection. Obviously, big differences between the Iraqi army and how they get their troops and train them and how we acquire our troops and train them. But they were human beings, and nobody wanted to be on the battlefield in terms of the soldiers, but we were there. And so, yeah, I felt for them.
Greg Downey and Alex Vernon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Downey and Alex Vernon contributed to the new book, The Eyes of Orion, about the ground war in Iraq 10 years ago. They spoke with NPR's Neil Conan. Coming up, the VJ recordings of Lee Morgan and Wayne Shorter. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. At the end of the 1950s, the Chicago R&B and gospel label VJ got into the jazz business, signing up local talents like saxophonist Eddie Harris and the quintet MJT Plus Three. They also signed two young New Yorkers working with Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, trumpeter Lee Morgan and saxophonist Wayne Shorter. Their VJ sides are now being reissued on two American labels. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead explains.
Blues a la Carte by tenor saxophonist Wayne Shorter with Lee Morgan on trumpet, 1959. A few years later, both these young lions would be much better known. In 1964, Morgan would have a big jukebox hit with The Sidewinder, and Shorter would join Miles Davis, helping make his quintet one of the great jazz groups. One reason for that was Shorter wrote them sleek tunes kind of like that one. Blues a la Carte was on his auspicious debut, introducing Wayne Shorter. Back then, he was still digesting what he'd learned from John Coltrane and Sonny Rollins. But he was already showing a gift for editing himself as he improvised, valuing space as well as sound. Wayne Shorter's Harry's Last Stand, with Jimmy Cobb dropping bombs at the drums, also from 1959. This music comes from the complete VJ Lee Morgan Wayne Shorter Sessions, a 6-CD box from the mail order house Mosaic Records. Shorter made other nice albums for VJ, but to these ears, his first was a standout. Trumpeter Lee Morgan had already made a few LPs and was fully developed as a soloist when he began recording for VJ in 1960. He was 21. Morgan could mimic Miles Davis using a Harmon mute, but when he really got rolling, the mute sounded like it might pop out of the bell. You can hear Morgan's punchy attack and amazing fluidity on his tune, Bess. Didn't anyone tell Lee Morgan trumpet's not supposed to do stuff like that? But for all his virtuosity, he knew something about letting space into a line too. These records sound fresh 40 years on, thanks to deft writing and excellent soloists, who also include Morgan's tenor saxophonist Clifford Jordan, and due to some great backing trios. The late 50s and early 60s was a golden age for jazz rhythm sections, with pianists playing light chords and bluesy little figures, bass players thumping away without boomy amplifiers, and drummers holding back but adding crisp accents. Here's Wynton Kelly on piano with bassist Paul Chambers and drummer Art Blakey on the same session. ¶¶ Coincidentally, Wynton Kelly and Paul Chambers share another new Mosaic box of VJ sessions. As usual with Mosaic, you get all available master takes and alternates, so you can hear the musicians coming to grips with the material or trying different solo strategies. With Lee Morgan and Wayne Shorter, there are only two or maybe three takes per piece, so it's not too repetitive. In an unusual but legitimate double-dip situation, the Koch label is now issuing much of the same material, most alternate takes included, on CDs patterned on the old LPs, with the original cover art and liner notes. So far, they've put out half the stuff in the box. The albums Here's Lee Morgan, the source of those last two numbers, and his Expubidant, plus Wayne Shorter's Waning Moments, alongside other good VJ stuff. Introducing Wayne Shorter is due out later in the year. But anyway they slice it, this stuff's as addictive as caffeinated chocolate nicotine.
Kevin Whitehead is currently based in Chicago. He reviewed the complete VJ Lee Morgan Wayne Shorter sessions on the Mosaic label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Confessions of a Shopaholic, a novel by British author Sophie Kinsella. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe. On the web at hollandamerica.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Life of Buddha, a talk with religion scholar Karen Armstrong about her new biography of Siddhartha Gautama, the man who attained enlightenment. Her other books include A History of God and The Battle for God. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.